Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello, welcome back, Surf Splendor listeners. I'm your host, David Scales. As always, appreciate you tuning back in for an all-new episode. I will keep it brief and just say thank you for all the feedback about last week's episode with Chaz Smith, the famed surf writer and co-founder of BeachGrit.com. Really great feedback from that episode. Everybody seemed to like Chaz a lot more than they expected to, which was exactly my feeling as well after interviewing Chaz. So he is welcome on the show at any time. I will extend that invite to him. Love to get his feedback just on surf news topics that come up throughout the year. So hopefully we'll be able to do that again. And then in regard to today's episode, slightly different format. It is surf news with Scott Bass, but we take the first 45 minutes of the show and interview. I kind of let Scott take the lead and interview Mark Price, who is the CEO of Firewire Surfboards, regarding the rumors that we started, basically, about Kelly Slater potentially purchasing the company or a majority share in the company anyways. So Mark addresses those rumors. You get the info straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And also Scott was a little unsure on the Firewire construction when we had our last show 2 weeks ago. So we wanted to invite Mark in to just kind of explain what the product is and the technology is from soup to nuts, so to speak. So enjoy that. If you're interested to listen to Mark's interview, it consists of the first 44 and a half minutes of the show, about 45 minutes. So enjoy that. And then if you want to go straight into surf news, just scrub it forward to the 45-minute mark. And the following 45 minutes is all just surf news, as per usual. All right. Thanks for listening. Follow us on social media if you care to follow. It's just at Surf Splendor. And then I'll be back at the end of the show to sign us off. Thanks.
Yeah, guy. Welcome, everybody, down the line, Surf Talk Radio. It is February 3rd. It's a Tuesday here in Southern California. We're broadcasting live from the Shack Library, Surfing Heritage and Culture Center Library. There is a plethora of books, and we're in this beautiful conference room. And we're very pleased, David Lee Scales, good morning.
Morning.
We're very pleased to say that we have a very special guest with us, Mark Price, the Chief Executive Officer of Firewire Surfboards. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Dave.
And Mark's here basically because last episode, 2 weeks ago, David and I were talking about Firewire Surfboards, and David pointedly said, Scott, you should know everything about Firewire Surfboards. So tell me, what is the construction process? And I, quite frankly, was stammering, trying to, lay down the build process, what exactly a Firewire surfboard is made of. How they're made. Now, since then, specifically this morning, I researched the hell out of it so that I'd be somewhat prepared. And it was really a lot of the same stuff that I did comment on. I don't know if you heard the show, Mark, but I said to David, I said, well, look, I believe it's EPS foam core construction with sandwich technology. And that's sort of the basics of it. And I know there's a lot more to it that once you sort of drill down into what a FireWire surfboard is made of, there's a lot more technology than just, hey, it's sandwich construction EPS a build. So why don't we start there? And why don't you talk about the different processes that go into the different, the FST, right, and the LFT
right.
Construction techniques of a firewall. But first of all, welcome. I know that was a mouthful introduction there, but welcome, Mark. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks, Scott. Well, you are correct. I mean, our boards are built from EPS foam and epoxy resins using sandwich construction. Perhaps the best way to describe them would be if you consider a center stringer polyurethane PU surfboard. We took the wood out of the middle of the board and placed it on the perimeter around the rails of the board, which allowed the board to flex. So sandwich construction has been around for quite a long time. There are many brands that use EPS foam and epoxy resins and sandwich construction. So there's a lot of similarities there between our product and other product out there. But when it comes to the placement of the wood rails around the perimeter of the board, that's the key difference. And from a performance perspective, probably the most important one. You know, we feel that like parabolic skis, skateboards, snowboards, controlled flex is a performance enhancer. And by placing the wood around the perimeter of the board, we've created an environment where the board can flex and rebound and optimize that flex pattern to increase the performance.
Now, I believe that it's the Future Shapes technology that has the parabolic wood on the rails, right? But I also noticed that the new linear flex technology has this unique center stringer as well as the parabolic.
No, you're halfway right. So FST, Future Shapes technology, is the original recipe. But we felt that, you know, there's many ways to skin the cat, and surfing is a very individual sport. And we wanted to create additional recipes around sandwich construction, EPS and epoxy, and flex. And we also felt that there's certain surfers just have a more traditional mindset in the way they look at their equipment. So LFT was a way to take the center stringer concept but build it around a flex component. So the LFT stringer, for want of a better description, is actually an 18 millimeter wide strip of high density foam.
That it's a springer, you call it, right?
You could
as
call
a marketing term.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, so a stringer has more of a rigid strength aspect to it and actually reduces flex. Whereas the LFT Springer, because it's foam-based, high-density aerospace composite foam, allows the board to flex. And it also gives the board, at least from the bottom deck, because you can't see it from the top deck, a more traditional look. And by taking the wood off the rails, you've got white rails and a more white look to the overall board itself, which has a more traditional aesthetic appeal to it.
And I can see, I will admit it, I'm probably one of those guys that would look at a board without a stringer in the middle and just go, oh, it's going to break, you know? And so it seems like the LFT, the linear flex with the springer in the middle, sort of, I would be that demographic, that guy that would go, oh, cool, look, it's got a center stringer. That's what I'm comfortable with. Even though I'm kind of clueless to the whole thing, it's almost like, let's just appeal to these guys that are basically idiots, you know? Like, you know what I mean? Like, for lack of a better phrase, like a naive guy like myself that's like, I can't ride a board without a center stringer, you know? And it feels like I could see myself going, you know what? I'm kind of moving towards that LFT technology just because that's what I'm quote unquote used to. That's what I'm comfortable with.
No, look, aside from not calling our customers idiots, you know, that was definitely part of our thought process to create a more traditional interpretation of flex. And at the same time, I actually, my personal preference is LFT because it has a slightly softer flex to it. So it flexes more than an FST board. And I just prefer really loading up, you know, through turns and bending the board as much as I can, which in fact tightens up the turning radius and gives you a little more twang coming out of turns. But it's a highly individual point of view. For example, Michelle and Sally obviously ride FST and prefer it. So, you know, who am I to judge?
Right.
But I think it is important to have different sensations in these different technologies because at the end of the day, surfing is about a feeling. We're all trying to grab a certain feeling that makes us feel good. And one flex ratio might appeal differently to another surfer. Yeah.
And, you know, so we've talked about this linear flex, which is that more traditional center stringer, and the FST, which is this parabolic stringer on the rails. And then you have TimberTech, right, which is this great, it came out in 2014, I believe, last year.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's sort of, I guess it appeals to sort of the maybe the older demo, again, like myself, that has had a million surfboards and would like to maybe move towards a more mature or a more, you know, responsible look at the way I surf. And so tell us about the TimberTech and the SuperSap.
Yeah, well, TimberTech was a great product for us. And interestingly enough, we didn't develop it. We refined it. You know, we have a reputation in the industry of having an open door. And we also have our own vertical factory that's pretty sophisticated. So we can build almost anything. So there's a lot of guys out there that have really great ideas and innovative products, but nowhere to take them to. They have no path to market because either they don't have the capital or they may not even have the inclination to get into the surfboard business. And so Grant Newby, who has a day job.
Yeah, I know Grant. Grant, yeah.
Great. So he approached us and said, look, I'll just show you how I build these boards. And
just a little backstory on Grant. He started the Fish Fry in Australia. We had it out here. It's sort of germinated in San Diego, and Sean and Madison and myself kind of did a little bit with it, and then Grant, great, let's do this, and that his Fish Fry at Corumban sort of evolved into a bunch of wood board guys started to show up there, and so that's the backstory of Grant.
And I think he's an audio visual engineer or something is his day job, but he's obviously great with his hands and builds his own boards. So he turned us on to his particular construction process, and we felt it needed some tweaks for various reasons to increase the performance, the lighten the weight a little bit. So our product development team worked in conjunction with Grant, and we refined it for our needs, nothing against the way he was building them. But the beauty of TimberTech, aside from the aesthetics of it, which I think are quite fantastic, the Polonia deck skins are certified sustainably grown. So there's that box to check from a sustainability standpoint. Bioresin throughout. And also because of the strength of the wood, it's 3 millimeters thick on the decks and up to 1/2 inch thick on the rails. We've cut down the cloth usage and resin usage considerably because the inherent strength of the foam core with wrapped in the wood is such that you don't need as much of a lamination or as much resin to create a durable surfboard. So it's probably from a globally available sold through surf shops. And those are important points because there's some guys on a backyard basis who are doing really innovative stuff. But when you look at it in terms of what's available for the average surfer, it is by far the most eco-friendly, sustainably built surfboard. It's not cradle to cradle by any stretch, but it's a huge step up from the traditional surfboard.
And that's got the 1 pound EPS as its foam core, and then this Polonia TimberTech on top and bottom, and the Entropy SuperSap resin. Is that
correct? Yeah. And the other important point, you know, when you talk about eco products, I think you're talking about sporting goods, you have to maintain very similar price points, and you certainly have to maintain or exceed existing performance standards. Otherwise, you're just creating a brick that's expensive.
Yeah.
And when you go surfing, no one's going to want to ride it.
Right.
And I think one of the beauties of TimberTech, it's ultra light, really strong, and has great flex. So it has all those boxes checked, and the price points are comparable to FST or LFT.
Why wouldn't we, and I guess I'm going to answer my own question, but my question is, why wouldn't we just have all TimberTech? Because it's a great product. It rides great. How hard is it to call Michelle Perez or Sally and go, hey, why don't you think about riding a TimberTech? Are we losing that much performance here?
Well, that's hard to say because actually Michelle has ridden Chopu on his TimberTechs. There's been photos of him 8 feet above the lip doing airs. So clearly he likes the tech. I think some of it comes down to, and you saw a little bit of this with Stu Kennedy when he was riding the ultra short Tomo boards at the US Open and whatnot. And I don't know if there is a bias on the judging panel.
A subconscious bias, perhaps.
Perhaps in the surfers' minds, if they get too out there on their equipment, possibly it may count against them in the top levels of professional surfing, possibly.
Yeah.
And I think that that might be a miscalculation, but I think that that thought process exists.
Sure.
Where they want to ride highly individualized equipment, but not too radically different from what the established competitive surfboard looks like.
Sure, that makes sense. And that kind of brings me to my next question, which is, look, Michelle was very close. He was leading the ratings at a certain point last year. Sally as well, I believe, was leading at some point. And she was also very close to being a WSL world champion. Now, aside from Taylor Jensen, who I believe won a world title on
two
of them,
and
I don't mean to marginalize what Taylor's done, but specific to high-performance shortboards, is 2015 going to be the year when we see a world champion riding a Firewire, you know, from Snapper to Pipeline and winning a world title? Is Michelle our guy, or Stu? Well, Stu's not on the CT, but is our year coming up? And maybe it's Sally, quite frankly. Maybe she has a better shot at it, not to take anything away from the Spartan, who we all love.
Well, I mean, I'm no good at predicting the future, but clearly they're contenders. And I think it's a matter of time before one of them, or perhaps a new addition to our team, does win a world title.
How about this? In 5 years, do you think we could see this happen? I mean, I think that's fair. I think 5 years is fair, considering the breakthroughs, especially now you've got Pizel coming on board. Like, you know, I mean, it could happen, not to mention what we're going to talk about next. So what is 5 years? Is 5 years?
Well, I would suggest this. If you want to go out 5 years, I would suggest that whether it's a Firewire rider or another brand rider, the way surfboard technology is evolving and EPS and epoxy are coming to the fore. You know, JS is experimenting with stringerless epoxies. There were some shots of Parco riding them. Kelly's been riding a lot of epoxy boards built by CI. So I would argue that it's just a matter of time before somebody wins a world title on an EPS epoxy surfboard. And
what about a sandwich construction board? But are all those boards custom boards anyway?
Well, those boards, you know, certainly in Kelly's case, they're non-sandwich.
Right.
And I'm not sure the construction of the JS boards.
Right.
As far as sandwich is concerned,
because I think that's the real big breakthrough, right?
Yeah.
I think when somebody wins on a sandwich, whether it be a SurfTech, a BoardWorks, a Firewire, whatever, at that point we've pushed over the tipping point, and we're like, you know what, it's all good. You know, for those last little naysayers, whoever they may be.
But I think, Scott, to your point, it's going to take other brands to have WSL. Is it WSL
or WSL? WSL,
yeah. No, sorry, it's early days.
Yeah, it is.
To have success at that level to tip the market. Even if Michelle won a world title on a sandwich construction, I don't think Firewire alone can tip the market into predominantly accepting sandwich construction surfboards. We need support from other brands to move in that direction.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, as you do know, SurfTech recently acquired some money thrown at SurfTech. They've revamped their whole surfboard line. It looks really slick. It looks really solid. Mm. Do you see this as a good thing for Firewire? That your competition, in my opinion, is sort of rising to the occasion, so to speak.
Absolutely. You know, we were actually pulling for Channel Islands to succeed with the double helix because back, and this is going back 3 or 4 years, because we felt that, again, we need other brands to endorse this type of construction. Or just
that was a SurfTech construction?
Or no, that was
the double helix. You might need to give me some backstory.
That was a stringerless construction with some type of carbon fiber or alternative cloth reinforcement around the rails that Channel Islands was working on once they were acquired by Burton.
Right.
And they spent a few years on it, and for whatever reason that I'm not familiar with, it wasn't a commercial success.
Right.
But my point was, you know, some people might have thought, whoa, Firewire is going to be threatened by this when we saw it. But it was the opposite. We were like, hey, guys, we're stoked. I hope it's a success.
But you know, I would argue that, look, it's not sandwich construction, right? It wasn't a sandwich construction, the double helix, was it?
It wasn't, but it got rid of the center stringer.
Right. And so
I think that's the key thing. You know, I don't think you have
that's
to get
interesting.
Too hung up on
sandwich. I'm hung up on the sandwich. I think that that's really the thing. I think that... I think that's the thing that the marketplace goes, but maybe I'm wrong. I've been wrong in the past. Maybe it is simply the aesthetic of the stringerless board that's the big push. But I feel like if we can get a guy to win a world title on a sandwich construction surfboard, wow, we've really moved the needle.
Well, look, I think you're right that will definitely move the needle. But I would still argue that I would like to see other brands endorse sandwich construction. And if it's only FireWire leading the charge, then there's only so much success we can have. Look, it's fantastic success and the brand is doing well. And I don't think you're ever going to see a situation where one brand completely dominates the surfboard market. It's very fragmented. And I think there's a certain health to that with the diversity that's available. But coming back to sandwich construction, one of the analogies we like to make as to why it's so good is the whole issue of swing weight. And when you think about it, the internal density of something has a huge effect on how it performs moving through space. So for example, you know, a baseball and a tennis ball are fairly similar in size and shape. But obviously when you throw them, they perform dramatically differently because the internal core densities are so different. And what sandwich construction allows you to do, to your point earlier, is to run, we even run 0.8 pound foam in some of the TimberTex. You can create an incredibly lightweight core, but because of the structural integrity of the high density skins, you can get away with it. So you have a surfboard that doesn't track, is far more maneuverable because your swing weight has been greatly reduced because your internal core density is so much lighter than a traditional surfboard.
In 5 to 10 years, or maybe sooner, maybe later, are we going to see a thing where the internal core actually has different densities so that maybe there's more weight in the front of the EPS core blank and there's less weight in the middle? And maybe, you know, right now it's all even the way the density of the blank is. Is there a situation where we can put more weight in the front if it starts to make sense? I mean, that seems like a place that hasn't been explored yet.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, there is a blank down in Australia that has hexagonal shapes of different densities that you can glue together to create different flex characteristics through the blank. Whether you do it that way or a project we're working on where we're creating adjustable flex through various internal mechanics, I think to your point, we are going to move into a direction where the internal performance of the board is not uniform. How you achieve it, there's a number of ways to do it. And certainly different density foams is a way, and certainly the way we're approaching it with a mechanism that will adjust the flex where it may be different in the nose, middle, and tail is certainly the next step.
Well, why don't we get to the elephant in the room, which is Kelly Slater. There's a huge rumor out there that Kelly Slater's looking into purchasing a large chunk of the FireWire business, perhaps owning a controlling interest in it. I know the company line's going to be, we're not saying a word because I've read what you've said, I think on Trax or Stab or wherever, and that makes tons of sense. So what can you say about the rumor that's going around? Kelly has mentioned some stuff, I'm sure you saw it, basically saying that, you know, I will address this stuff soon. It's nothing definite. It sounds like you guys are still kind of like, you know, going through back and forth with lawyers and so forth and so on. But he does say something interesting, which is, you know, If Kelly Slater is going to wave the flag of sustainability, which he wants to do, which I think we all applaud, which I think we all should do, and why not have Kelly do it? What a perfect situation. Then I have to point the finger at myself being Kelly Slater. Kelly has to point at himself and go, well, what's my role in this? I need to address my boards. And it seems like this is one of the things he's doing. He's like, well, which manufacturer out there is best handling this? And FireWire seems to be that one, so I'm going to approach them. Again, I'm reading a lot into this. I'm making a lot of assumptions, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on some of that.
Well, before I answer that specific question, let me just say that when it comes to eco initiatives, you know, we are the only global manufacturer who only produces eco boards as certified by sustainablesurf.org. Our entire product line is built using bioresins, the Entropy SuperSap. And in addition to that, we use the BAST packaging, which is 100% post-consumer molded pulp, reusable, recyclable system. All of our waste is disposed of in you know, eco-friendly ways and whatnot. So we do feel that while we've still got a hell of a long way to go, we've taken some important steps in reducing our CO2 emissions and our overall carbon footprint. And a lot of people then turn around and say, well, yeah, but if you're shipping boards, you know, from Asia around the world, then you're basically undoing all that good. And I just want to point out that in the life cycle analysis that's been done around products, and Patagonia was one of the lead companies that did this because they were very concerned about building their products in Asia and the freight components to that. The shipping costs, and this is not air, this is sea, which is obviously what we use, are less than 2% of the CO2 emissions of all the input materials and costs associated with the product. So the shipping thing is a bit of a red herring that people throw out there that, that doesn't really...
And speaking of red herrings, stuff. If I can just chime in about that, because I may, again, be naive or ignorant about this, but I've always felt that waving our flag as environmentally conscious people, surfers, surf industry people, manufacturers, any of us in this world, is more of just that we're waving our flag. That in fact, the little bit of footprint that we either add to or take away from is really negligible, relevant to the entire world and what the footprint of, say, this Apple computer is relative to, say, a surfboard. You know, I don't think, and again, I could be wrong, but I think it's more that we as a lifestyle, as surfers have the ability to do it, and we're doing it. We're raising the flag and going, hey, you know what? Yeah, in the big picture, the pie chart, we're barely a sliver. What we're saving or what we're adding to the carbon footprint is nothing. But what we are doing is going, it's important for us to do this.
Look, I agree. And I think to make an analogy on a topic that's fairly current today with the release of Selma, I don't think that the first few African Americans that sat at a lunch counter realized the ramifications of what would happen over time through that first act. And I'm not saying that surfers are going to change the world the way, the civil rights movement changed the US, but it's certainly calling attention to the issue, and only good things can come from that. And I think you've got to put it in that fairly little narrower context within our own world and go, we need to do the right thing and hopefully the rest will take care of itself. But to your point, we're not cleaning up the environment by making our surfboards less toxic.
Yeah. So Kelly.
Back to your question.
So to Kelly.
look, what I can say is Kelly has made an offer to purchase a majority stake in Firewire. We're going through all the legal lees and protocols that are necessary to come to a conclusion. It's at the offer stage. And I hate ducking a question.
No, I respect it. I understand.
I literally
it's
cannot
business.
Comment more than that.
I totally get it.
But it's certainly, he has made an offer to secure a majority stake, and we're actively pursuing that.
Now, some hypotheticals, assuming that it does go through, because I think it will go through. I think it's a win-win-win for everybody. Does that mean that we're gonna see Channel Islands boards? You've got an interesting model, right? You almost license your manufacturing process to these different brands like Pizel, like Tomo, like Mayhem, like Matt Biolas and the Lost Guys. Would it be a situation where we would see the Channel Islands line start to be manufactured using your techniques?
Look, I cannot get into specifics.
Okay. All right.
But let me just
would
say,
you like that? The door is locked, Mark. You can't leave.
Let me just correct the record a little bit.
Sure, please.
We pay a royalty to Pizel for his designs, and obviously to Lost and to Tomo, and we build those designs in our own factory. So technically, you're correct that there is a licensing relationship there. But at the same time, we also have this mothership that's the Firewire brand that we've built and developed in its own right and has its legitimate place in the market. So I think it's important to distinguish what we're doing from, say, the SurfTech model. And let's just go back to the original SurfTech model, because right now it may be a little bit in limbo as to exactly how they're going to move forward with the new product. But historically, SurfTech was basically a licensing company that was just built boards for other brands under license, and that was really how they built their business. We have a much more hands-on approach. We want to build brands. So for example, in the Tomo case, aside from a certain amount of custom boards that he's free to build at any time for anyone of his choosing, all stock Tomo boards at retail are built by us. We've just overhauled his website. We do the demos. We place the ads in conjunction with Dan. I mean, he's very involved in the brand, so I don't want to act as if he's just over there and we do everything. But it's much more of a brand development relationship versus, hey, here's a check, let us just run with these couple designs.
With that understanding that, then you could argue that, well, Channel Islands already has a built brand. They're pretty damn strong. They might not need that from Firewire, as I, again, forward here.
My personal feeling is that I would rather see us do more with less. So I would rather see us continue to strengthen the Firewire business, strengthen our relationship with Barzal, obviously expand the Tomo business, and then wherever Kelly wants to go, support that. But my own personal feeling is we don't really want to become a board builder for other brands, you know, right, as our primary right business. It's a lower margin business. It strengthens their business, in our opinion, because it's giving them our technology, which is proprietary to us.
Right.
So it's not my first choice.
Right.
But there's strong arguments that could be made that it's a good business opportunity, and we'll see how things play out. You know, at this point in time, the whole focus is on moving the deal forward and right crossing all those I's and dotting those T's, and we actually haven't spent much time on what comes afterwards.
Right.
There'll be plenty of time to address that in the coming months.
Have you spoken with Kelly?
Yes.
And were those preliminary discussions exciting, and can you give us any insight into that? Because I'm sure some of the stuff that you and I were just now talking about came into the equation when the preliminary phone calls went down.
Look, it would be disingenuous to suggest that we've had no conversations about anything. You right know? Of course we have. But we've kept it really loose. And at the same time, we're very respectful of what Kelly is facing in the short term.
Right.
And that is showing up at Snap and winning the event.
Right.
Whatever boards he wants to ride in order sure to do that, he should. And in fact, we're not even working on boards for him right now. All parties agreed that, listen, let's just see where this deal goes, and then we'll cross those bridges when we get to them. So it's been fairly superficial, but and obviously good, we've had some conversations.
Right. You know? And I appreciate you giving me as much insight as you can understand. I understand these things, you know, the business side of what you have to, sure, you know, basically you have to be quiet. David and I were talking at the last episode about, these are some things that we do know. We do know that it's on video. We have proof that Kelly's semi-enamored with what Daniel's doing, Tomo. Mm-hmm. He's seen what Stu Kennedy was doing. He's on video saying that he thinks that what Daniel's creating is the future. So I don't think it would be a stretch to suggest that he would at least, and if I'm sure he already has, give those boards a run, or that concept a run, you know. And of course, I know Kelly well enough to know that he would respect, you know, he would work with Daniel on some level. And mm-hmm. and he and David and I were talking about, wouldn't it be neat if Kelly gets to work with Paizel and ride some of the stuff that John's riding, and he gets to work with Daniel and get, you know, gets to ride some of that. And because we all know that Kelly really moves the needle, and as he should, because he is so involved in it. I mean, he knows the stuff. He knows the designs. In fact, I was reading a thing with Maurice Cole the other day about how well Kelly can continue the conversation about board design and fin design and placement and volume and all of these factors. Wouldn't it be neat? You know, I mean, I think we're all excited as fans of Kelly Slater to see him try all these different things and see how they go. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on the exciting factor of Kelly riding a bunch of different boards if and when this does come out.
Oh, definitely. And I think, and I can't speak for Kelly, but I think somewhere in his mind, part of the calculation is he'll be able to work with whoever he wants, whether it's Paizel, Tomo, continue his relationship with Weber that he started right now. You know, he's gotten some boards from him.
Really?
That's out in the public domain. I'm not sharing any
Greg
secrets
Weber?
There. Yeah.
From Australia.
Yeah.
Surf pool Weber.
Yeah.
And Kelly Slater wave pool Weber. That's very interesting to me. Now you've got me.
Yeah.
We're going to have to call Chaz Smith.
You gotta brush up on your blogs, man.
Well, I guess so. There's so many out there, but I just sensed that there was some animosity based on the wave pool stuff with Kelly and Greg. But apparently, it's just, again, maybe I do need to brush up on my blogs.
Yeah, but to your point, you know, I think that if this deal goes through, Kelly would have the freedom to work with whoever he wanted. And in fact, we could potentially develop new technologies around his particular interests.
You know, we've mentioned Paizel and Matt Biolas and Daniel Thompson and the potential now that Kelly comes in, and who knows what happens if in fact he does come in with Mike from Channel Islands or whoever. My point is that these guys are all very proud people, as they should be. I mean, they've chosen this profession of building surfboards. It's basically a passion play. It's a lifestyle play. There's not a lot of money in it. And because of that, it's very personal to them. And I know it's personal to all of these guys. Is it hard for you? Is it hard to manage these personalities? Do you even have to manage these personalities? Are there little dramas that take place that are maybe bigger than they should be on occasion? I'll take that as a yes.
Well, no, look, fortunately for me, you know, I've spent my whole career on the creative side of the business. So whether it was working with designers or graphic artists or merchandisers, you know, people like Sean Stussy, Peter Schroff, Mike Salisbury. I mean, I've learned a lot from some really creative people over the years. And I've also, I think I've developed a management style that is effective in getting the best out of, you know, creative people, whereas also giving them the freedom to grow themselves and express themselves. It's always a balance, you know, commercializing product between the pure design inputs and what the market will really bear. So I think I've walked that line my whole career. So it's stood me in good stead in working with these individuals. And I think what helps me is that at the end of the day, I just have such incredible respect for whether it's the literal craftsmanship of these guys being able to pick up a plane and create this thing, or just the sheer design knowledge that they have. And certainly in say, Dan Thompson's case, his surfing ability on top of that. You know, so it has its challenges, but I think they're no different from any business that has a bunch of people under one roof or in conjunction with a company trying to create something in a collective way. There's going to be personality issues, professional issues that emerge, but they're totally manageable. That said, you know, there are certain people out there who could probably benefit our business that we consciously won't work with. So yeah, there are some lines that we draw, no right, matter how creative you are,
right?
Because it's just there's a poisonous chemistry to a business that has to be maintained, and if you don't put some parameters in place, the whole thing can blow up.
Yeah, there are three events on the 2015 tour, which are unsponsored, do not have a title sponsor. They're the Fiji Pro, I think the Rio Pro, the Fiji Pro, and the Jay Bay Open. Could we see in the future the Firewire Fiji Open or the Firewire Fiji Pro, the Fiji, the Firewire Jay Bay Open? This seems like, and I don't know what the cost is, I'm sure it's a lot, but this seems like... I guess as a guy who produces surf, who loves surfboards like you do, I would right, love to see a WSL event that's sponsored by a surfboard company. I don't know if it's in the budget or not, but is that something that you guys even chew on and talk about? Is that in the realm of possibility?
No. You know, surfboard companies are pretty small in the scheme of things. And
there's no ROI, basically, on
it. I think it's just beyond our financial capacity to fund something like that, period. Never mind whether there's an ROI or not.
Right.
You know, I mean, the prize money alone and the various sponsorships involved are infinitely greater than our entire marketing budget for all facets of it. And I would also argue that, and this is where I might just be old school about it, I think that there's a certain level of visibility and firepower in the market that you really don't want to go beyond as a surfboard brand. There's a certain soul
to the
product.
You don't want to jump the shark, so to speak.
Yeah, you don't want to come across as too big.
Right.
And the facts are you can't get too big anyway because the market's kind of small. But if someone just wanted to write a check because they want the ego gratification of having a name attached to it, I guess that's possible.
Right.
But we don't make decisions on that basis.
Right. I will say this. I saw Mark a couple, 3 years ago come out of the water. I saw him getting some great little barrels at George's there in Cardiff, and he had just gotten a new Tomo, one of the new Vanguards, and I could see the spark in his eye. He was stoked on the thing. His smallest board he's ever ridden, and it was just, you know, I could tell he was fired up.
That's always one of the closing questions when we're interviewing somebody is just, what was the last board that you rode?
The last board, well, the board I'm currently riding is the Cornice, which is a side-cut snowboard-esque design that we developed in conjunction with some engineers out of Spain who design wind turbine blades. And they have massive amounts of computing power where they obviously test how these giant blades perform in various environments. And being surfers, they started modeling various surfboard shapes and putting them through these computer programs. And we took that original concept, much like the Grant Newbie relationship, and we tweaked it quite a bit. And we now have this collaborative product that Dan Mann from Mankind actually designed in conjunction with the guys from Spain. And it's an amazing design. It's only 17 inches wide at the wide point. It's a 5.5. And I'm having a lot of fun on that.
When you say side cut, is that in reference to the outline?
Correct.
So it's like asymmetrical?
No, it's totally symmetrical, but it basically, instead of having a curve from nose to tail, it actually curves inwards.
Understood.
And
Dan used to work with FireWire. Does he still does. Still involved?
Yeah. And then I go back and forth between that and the Vader, you know, which is one of the newer Tomo designs. Mm. They all work on a similar principle, and that's basically making the board as small as humanly possible and still getting, you know, first-rate performance out of it.
Sure.
I am one of the best of show. Well, this year's best of show category, the only category, is a sustainable, environmentally conscious surfboard. And the judging is going to be based on how far can we push the parameters, push the limit of environmentally conscious building materials, source materials, and still maintain performance in the water. And obviously, you guys are at the forefront there, and I expect that you guys will put a board in the competition. But again, it's only for this idea that let's push the limits here. I mean, let's raise the flag. You know, I know we're not saving the world, but let's do what's in our heart. Let's do the right thing. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I think it'd be cool. I mean, there's definitely more room to move.
Yeah.
It's challenging because it's got to be lightweight. It's got to float. It's got to be strong. It's got to rip. But, you know, it can be done.
Like linseed oils, stuff like that. Where's the next breakthrough in environmentally conscious source materials? Do you have any thoughts on that? Or, I mean, how much lighter can we get? I guess, how much stronger can we get? You know, or I guess the real question is, how much more environmentally conscious can we get?
We can definitely get lighter and stronger. And we're working on some vacuum laminations right now, which obviously reduces the amount of resin that's used and also increases the mechanical bond. There's also materials that have been proven in other industries and manufacturing processes that will create lighter and stronger surfboards. So one of the benefits we have is that we don't have to reinvent the wheel because it's been done in other industries. We might have to tweak it to make it right for us. So there's that side of it. But coming back to the linseed comment that you made, we actually had to add cloth to the TimberTech boards. They don't require it. In fact, Grant Newby doesn't glass his boards at all. He just coats them with linseed oil, which not only seals the wood, but it has a tacky feel to it. You don't even need wax at all. But when you're shipping boards all over the world and guys are scraping wax off with scrapers and pulling traction pads off, you know, we felt that we had to just put a layer of cloth that's just 2.5 ounce around the exterior of the board just to give it some additional integrity for the abuse that the average surfer puts it through. Now, if each surfer were to baby their board and recoat it with linseed oil every couple months, your TimberTech board would last forever and you wouldn't have to worry. But, you know, we have to look out for the worst case scenario.
Right.
And so we actually added some cloth to the board that isn't really required.
Yeah.
So when you start getting into the real purist approach to it, there's a lot that can be done. But then on the flip side is the maintenance and care for your board has to go up.
Right.
And I think a lot of surfers probably aren't willing to take those extra steps on a regular basis to look after the product.
And what about, we've had mushroom blanks at the boardroom before, a very experimental guys that are coming in and just basically, not necessarily first to market, just first with a crazy idea more than anything. Are you looking at the cores? Are you happy with EPS? Does that seem to be, obviously it's a no-brainer, but is in 5 or 10 years, are we going to see something besides that EPS foam? Are we going to see an algae-based foam or a mushroom-based foam?
Without question. Because when you look at the use of foam, say EPS, for example, it's used in refrigeration panels all over the world. It's used in electronics packaging. So the incentive to create more eco-friendly alternatives is huge. I mean, the business potential is in the billions. So I think the surfboard industry is going to be the beneficiary of the needs of these far greater industries.
As almost a test market,
exactly.
More than anything.
And so, the problem with the mushroom foam right now is they can't get the densities low enough.
It's pretty heavy.
They could overcome that. Yeah. The biome foam that Rob Falcon was working with out of Holland is showing tremendous promise.
Wow.
There's some guys in Israel right now working on some really interesting stuff. So I think it's just a matter of time before there's a wholesale change in the type of materials that surfboards are built from.
Yeah, I know there's a guy at UCSD that's working on some algae, basically waste from stuff they're already doing that they can blow into foam. So there's a lot out there. It's good stuff. Well, we're excited about Kelly Slater being a part of Firewire. I know it's not a done deal, and for the record, Mark's not saying it is, but the conventional wisdom, the masses out there seem, the rumor mill is strong, and it's going to be fun to see what happens. You know, I think it's a great thing as a guy who's in the surfboard manufacturing business on some peripheral, in some way, it's exciting. You know, there's a lot of good stuff that's gonna flow from it, and so I'm jazzed.
Totally. Me too.
Thank you, Mark. Mark Price from Firewire. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
So on the heels of talking with Mark there, and I mentioned it too, so Kelly Slater's joined forces with this brand PB Teen. Peanut Butter Teen, PB Teen, right?
Yeah.
To make this line of environmentally friendly furniture.
Yeah.
That's my first story, and it sort of seems underwhelming after that great conversation with Mark Price. So.
Well, it's so random.
Yeah, that's
it's
what
like,
it was.
What? It has nothing to do with surfing, which I get, like branch out, but it is furniture is as out of left field as you could get, I suppose.
Yeah, it's... You know, my wheels start turning. I'm like, okay, so his managers, like Kelly, they called us. This would be pretty much a no-brainer. No one would even notice.
Right.
You're going to make like a killing. You know, your margin's going to be sick on this. And they've, you know, it's a no-brainer. All you got to do is sign off on it. And Kelly's like, all right, I'll do it. You know, just move on.
But that's, we don't know Kelly to take a money grab.
No, you're right.
You know,
right.
That's
right.
The weird thing about it is it feels like a money grab.
Yeah, and I don't think it is. I sense that Kelly's really trying to align every single product he makes with his core values. And so
I'm not saying it doesn't align with his core values.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a money grab. I think it just came to, like, it just showed up at their doorstep and they're
right.
Like, dude, it lines up, you know. You know, if again, who knows? We're just assuming a lot here, but I don't know if it was a money grab. I just think it lined up with his core values, and I think anything that lines up with his core values, he'll be like, "Yeah. You know what? Michael Jordan underwear, Kelly Slater, you know, furniture."
Yeah, I have no shame about that at all. Like, I would take the cash payout too. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Do you remember though, like back in the day, you know, even 10, 20 years ago, you'd see these A-list actors in movies. You would never see them do a hair care commercial. You know what I mean?
Right.
And nowadays,
it's like it's open game for everybody. Shaquille O'Neal has a soda, you know what I mean? And J.K. Simmons, this actor who's in like this movie Whiplash that's nominated for Best Actor of the Year, is also doing State Farm commercials at the same exact time, simultaneously.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's a different market nowadays.
Well, I'm going to read his quote from the press release about the furniture. This is from Kelly. Global conservation is a focal point of the capsule collection, and it falls right in line with the change in direction I'm working towards on a professional and personal basis, said Slater, 11-time world champion. In collaborating with PB Teen, we are creating a subtle and natural feel with this collection, something that has an authentic appeal for teens and their parents alike. Which part of that quote did he not write? Because there's no way he wrote that second part.
Yeah.
That just has PR speak all over it. Could you imagine these words coming out? In collaborating with PB Teen, we are creating a subtle and natural feel with this collection, something that has an authentic appeal for teens and their parents alike. That was not said by Kelly Slater. Right. I think the first part probably was. Global conservation is a focal point. Anyway, funny stuff.
Interesting. Did you see his Super Bowl commercial?
Yeah, that was cool.
So it
I was
actually
stoked on that.
It was an NFL commercial and
Super Bowl rally, right?
Hashtag Super Bowl rally.
Yeah.
And basically the NFL, it was for the NFL brand, but the concept was to like show people giving a rally cry around the world. Different, you know, it'd be like sports teams for sure, but then it would show like a mom cheering her kid on in his soccer game. And it showed Kelly taking a selfie in a barrel, looked like backdoor or P-Pass or some giant right-hand barrel, holding a GoPro pointed at himself, screaming as he's going through the barrel. So they just took like a tenth of a second almost and incorporated it into a one-minute long commercial.
And then he put an Insta out there about it. Yeah, which was kind of cool. He's like, check out my moment. And then he pointed his camera towards the commercial as it was happening, right?
Yeah.
And then he like brought the camera to himself and went, and like kind of screamed.
For the Instagram.
Yeah, for the Instagram. Yeah.
Have you seen his Apple commercial that he did in 2002?
No.
It's solid, dude.
He did an Apple commercial in 2002.
2002.
13 years ago.
Kelly Slater did a 30-second spot for Apple. They were advertising some new software for, you know, one of their computers, basically. And they partnered with a bunch of different athletes to talk about how they would use the software. It was video editing software. So Kelly's standing there. It's like a classic Apple ad where there's a white backdrop. He's standing in front of it with his surfboard all stickered up with logos. And he's like, yeah, you know, I started using this new software. I got footage of myself surfing Snapper Rocks, and they show the footage and I edited it together.
It must be iMovie.
It was an iMovie. It was something else that I forget.
Final Cut?
Actually,
it was Apple software?
No. Yeah. It's something. I'll look it up right now while I'm talking.
Don't worry about it.
But Switch.
Nothing spectacular. Just cruising. Sort of really basic surf stuff. Just some small, perfect little waves. My everyday thing, really. Put music to it, put captions in. And I've never done that stuff before. And it took me about an hour to edit. Pretty easy. iMovie program is so simple to use.
Apple.com/switch. So I guess the iMovie program, but some product they have called Switch is what they're advertising. But he just talks about editing this thing together.
I think Switch, maybe like Switch from Final Cut to Apple to iMovie.
Maybe that's what it was. Smart, dude. Look at you.
I know.
Get a background in marketing or something?
Occasionally, a little gem falls out.
but 2002 was like prior to the internet being crazy. Like, if he came out with this today, we would all have seen it on the internet. But back then,
you know what I was thinking, speaking of time and a long time ago in 2002, was this morning when I was preparing for Mark, I realized that it's 2015. It's 10 years since the closure of Clark Foam. Oof. This December will mark the 10-year anniversary.
December 5th?
Yeah. Of Black Monday?
Yep.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting, something that maybe we can build up to in future episodes.
Maybe
we can get some insight from people. I'm sure somebody now is going to listen to this and write a whole article on it.
Well, I mean, I would love to get the full story, you know, like from Grubby himself.
It might be a good documentary film.
It would be a super good documentary because I've talked to various people about it. Everybody has a different story.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh no, he was a really shrewd businessman, but a good human being. And then I talked to
a lot of other people were like, heck no, that guy was a nightmare, you know?
You know what my story is that I was at the Surfer House on the North Shore when that all came down. Like, we were all in there. There was a bunch of us upstairs. And Chris Morrow came in, or somebody came in with, like, or whoever it was, I forget.
Yeah.
Might have been Evan, but it was like, you guys aren't going to believe this. And, like, everyone kind of gathered around, and we read the facts, and it was like, do you know what this means? The surfing, you know, it was like a big, it was a big deal in our little world of the surf industry.
It was big outside of the surf industry. It sent ripple effects through the financial world, you know? I mean, the Wall Street Journal wrote about it. It was
everybody was just sort of wonder, you know, hypothetical, what's going to happen? How's it going to play out? You know, what's it mean? Should we go buy a bunch of surfboards? Who's got blanks? You know,
yeah,
there was guys, you know, there was guys making a, that were just making a run on boards. I know that, I think at the Surf Ride in Oceanside, Sean Madison immediately, like, he was the manager there. I think he immediately marked up every board like $500 or something. There was a run on surfboards.
Yeah, exactly. It should be stated.
I wonder how many Clark blanks are still floating around out there.
I see them sometimes.
I've seen them. Yeah, I know they're out there.
It should be stated, too, that kind of the key employees from Clark regrouped after about 6 months to a year, launched U.S. blanks.
Yeah, exactly.
Which has kind of filled the gap for Clark. There was a few other companies that tried to fill the gap in the interim, but U.S. blanks is certainly...
there's no doubt that they are the new Clark foam.
Better than... You know, like from everybody I talked to in terms of just consistency and quality, because that's the other thing is when Clark had kind of a monopoly, there's no competition to hold you accountable and to require you to improve your craft. Now there's enough competition pushing the envelope that you have to always regroup, tighten your belt, do things more efficiently, better customer service, you know?
Yeah, I think the thing that gave them the real big head start, right, was that they had all the rocker templates already, you know? Yeah. And so it was...
Well, and 30-plus years of know-how.
Yeah, and it was the same people, right? It was Kim, and I think it was a lot of the same people. So there was a lot of relationships that had already been built.
Over 30 of the staff
yeah.
came and started the new brand. So without Grubby, of course, no Grubby involvement.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Yeah, 10-year anniversary.
Yeah. Cool. Did you watch the Vulcan Pipe Pro?
I did. I did watch the Vulcan Pipe Pro.
Dude, John wins again. I mean, is there any, there's a lot of middle story, but the reality is, hey, guess what? There's another event at Pipeline. Kelly and John are both in the final. John smokes everybody.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing for fans. You know, I love it when John went. John's slowly getting to that place in my own fandom that equals Kelly. Like, I, you know, those two guys are my favorite surfers, is I guess what I'm saying. And
yeah.
The reason it's a good thing is I think it pushes Kelly to be excited for this year.
I just made the analogy with the phone business. It's the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
You need an adversary.
Yeah, and before, you know, as we all know, it was Andy for a bit, and it's now it's Gabriel and John. I just think it's great for Kelly's Eye of the Tiger.
So obviously, when it comes down to the showdown heat between the top two surfers in the final, it could go either way.
Yeah.
You look at that final in Tahiti with Kelly and Gabriel, you know, and it's
a matter
like,
of rhythm almost, you know?
It really is, and it's like one heat could be one guy's, the next heat could be another. They're that good, and it's just splitting hairs. But leading up to the final throughout the event, I'm constantly assessing who are the top guys in this event. Kelly, without a doubt, is the top guy on his end of the draw, and John on his end of the draw is the top guy. There's nobody else that even comes close to those two guys. It's like black and white. I mean, the third guy in line, Mason Ho, who got second in the final actually, or some of the other highlights were like Zeke Lau surfed great. They're still 10 notches below Kelly and John. Kelly and John are on a different planet.
It was a bit disappointing to not see Jamie O'Brien in the final.
But Jamie O'Brien is amazing waves that we've seen him ride at Pipeline, and as comfortable as he seems, I would argue is not on the level of John and Kelly. He certainly isn't competitively.
Yeah, not competitively. I would say in the free surf circuit, he's right there. He's got to be, I mean, let's say it goes like this. Let's say it goes John Slater, who's number three out at Pipe?
Jamie
O'Brien.
He is, but
he could arguably be number two.
No, I would argue he's definitely number three.
I mean, in the free surf world.
I agree.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he looks so comfortable at pipe. I've never really seen him do it backdoor, what we've seen John and Kelly do.
Oh, I've seen him do stuff at backdoor. He's incredible.
I'm not trying to diminish Jamie. I don't know. I got a question for you, though, regarding backdoor. Is backdoor the new pipeline? I feel like all these great showdowns we see.
It has been for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, backdoor pipe's always been really what decides pipe.
It really does.
It's very rare that it's the left that decides it.
Yeah.
Because for whatever reason, I think let's figure this out. Yeah. But we know that regular foots can go backside on the left and get sick shacks. And then they can get the killer backdoor tubes on their front side. Yeah. I think the backdoor barrel on your backhand for the goofy footers is much harder.
Very much.
So I think that speaks a lot to why we see a lot of regular foots winning and a lot of times backdoor being where it's at.
Well,
it's a longer tube.
Yeah,
it's a longer, more critical tube. You're going to get a 10 more often than not on the right than you are on the left.
Because it's running down the reef and it closes out on the end.
That section.
So the pipeline wave, the left, it's a big, wide open, cavernous barrel that gets perfect. So you can just stand there and get blown out.
You're trying hard to get deeper on the left, yeah. Whereas the right, you're running for your life.
But that wave that Kelly got last year in the Vulcan Pipe Pro, and I think a couple that he got actually at the Billabong Pro at Pipeline, reignited our excitement for Pipeline, because there was like death-defying drops, stomps it, gets blown out, but he made it difficult to ride. You know what I mean? Like, you don't see that happen very often at Pipeline anymore. More often than not, you see a guy take off deep and get blown out, and that can account for a perfect 10. But at backdoor, there's a lot more rider input. There's a lot more negotiations that are made and weaving through the barrel. We saw it multiple times in this event. We saw Kelly get a 10 doing that. And then the other element that's interesting with backdoor is we saw in John John's first big score in the final, him do a massive air when he came out of the barrel, which we're going to see more of in the future, guys coming out and doing massive airs, which is something you don't see at Pipeline. You rarely see at Pipeline.
And you know, another thing too is that back in the day, like say late 80s, early 90s, the contest organizers would wait for a big west swell. They'd be like, big west swell, we've got to, because it was all about the left, you know, we need a west swell. And as soon as it started to go a little bit north, they'd put it on hold and they'd wait for the next west swell to come through if they could. But as we know, the nature of these swells is they move across the Pacific from the Kuril Islands underneath Japan all the way over, until finally they reach, you know, the west coast of North America. And as they do that, the swells become more northerly in direction, of course. And so the right-hander shows up more. And so we wait for the big west swell. We get a couple of rounds in the big west swell. And then all of a sudden, backdoor and the left start to work. And then it's more of backdoor. And then let's say we wait for the next round, you know, the last couple of rounds. And again, it happens. We wait for the west swell. And then as we get towards the quarters, the semis, and the finals, the swell has swept to a place where, again, it's more about the north, more about the back door.
Yeah, we're not going to get that many west swells in this 10-day waiting period.
Right, and especially on the final day. Right. You know, there was a couple of days. There was one great day. The day, I think it was 2000, the year that Machado beat Mick Lowe in the final. It was epic. All lefts, just crystal clear, not a drop of water out of place, just perfect left, real pipeline. Mm-hmm. And Machado won it. And that was 2000. And God, what an exciting time it was to see. I kind of hope for the left a lot of times because it almost is like, we don't see the left as much as we used to. And I'm trying to think, what was the other, can you name a goofy foot that won pipeline since Machado in 2000? At real pipe.
Jeez.
Think back, you know, like it's Fanning, Parco, Slater, John, Jamie O'Brien.
Andy.
Andy. Then like Bede and Jeremy Flores.
Yeah, crazy.
There's not too many goofies that have ever, you know. When was the last goofy?
I don't know, but.
I guess Gabe Medina, right? He just won it. Oh, he didn't win. Oh, yeah.
No. Oh, wait, did he? No, Julian Wilson.
That's right, Julian.
Dang, so, we have terrible short-term memory.
Yeah, we do. We're all, it's okay.
You're calling guys out from 2000, but can't remember 2 weeks ago.
That's how it works. What's his name? Oh, Gabe Medina. So anyway, that's interesting, right?
Like, it is very interesting.
I wonder if Machado was the last Goofy Foot to win in 2000, 15 years ago. We need to do some research.
I think I heard it on the webcast, somebody telling the story about Machado right around that time, which was Kelly telling him, like, dude, you should go right out here. Go back door. And Machado was too scared. He's like, no way, man. The lefts are so perfect. Why would I even think to go right? And then they had a heat together. Machado went on his first backdoor wave ever, got a 10. and it was like, thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, that day was just all time, and the heats that Mick Lowe, who you may not remember.
I remember Mick Lowe, big, Goofy Foot.
Yeah, big Aussie, keggy kind of the showdown that those two had was just all time, and it was just perfect, flawless pipe.
Well, Pipeline did rear its ugly head for a couple days of the waiting period, and we had some pretty serious injuries, actually. Leo Fioravanti, who's this Italian surfer, he's actually from Rome, regular footer. He's part of the Quicksilver Grom team. I've spent a little bit of time with him. He actually broke his back at Pipeline during the event. Took off on a super steep wave, free fall dropped, fins didn't catch, kind of spun out at the bottom, and the thing just clamped on him. He hit the reef directly on his back, like pinned against the reef on his back, and then the wave kind of broke on him, so forced him deeper into it, broke two vertebrae, had to get pulled from the water. They weren't sure how bad it was, took him to the hospital, and now he's in a back brace, but he's like 17-year-old Grom, broken back at Pipe, pretty gnarly.
Yeah, that's sad.
During
a
heat.
That's a bummer, man.
And then did you see last night the injury?
I don't think I did.
Pretty gnarly situation. Just, I was following it on Instagram late last night. Tahitian surfer, he's on Volcom. I'll pull up his name while we're talking, but he wiped out. I didn't hear anybody talk about the wipeout, but they found him unconscious. Apparently the board hit him in the head, and the lifeguards pulled him out of the water unconscious to the beach, tried to revive him on the beach for a long time and weren't able to. So they got him in an ambulance, got him to the hospital where he's in critical condition.
Wow.
So as of this morning, it's all people just shouting out, hey, send prayers his way. Because he's still alive, but he's in critical condition and unconscious. I'm going to pull up his name.
That's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that, man. That's a total downer.
Tahiti Haimani is his name. So listeners will get more information about him before we're able to update them. But yeah, pretty gnarly guy. I guess he surfs Chopu. You know, the guy's from Tahiti, so he's fully capable of doing his thing. But critical condition at the moment.
Well, that's a bummer. Let's see, other stuff about the Volcom Pipe Pro. Really, like you said, nothing too surprising.
Zeke Lau
was great to watch. There was tons of action. The swell was like mid-period. There was tons of waves coming in, it seemed like. There was always action going on.
Yeah.
It was a pretty good broadcast. I enjoy Richard Wolcott. You know, I think he does a good job.
I love Dave Wassel.
Ronnie Blake, he's always great. You know, Chris actually did, again, I think Cote does a pretty good job. He's toned down his, you know, Chris is pretty good.
Yeah, I like him.
So
one thing that, I don't know whether we talk about sponsor talk really, if it matters, but kind of interesting to me, Zeke Lau, up and coming Hawaiian powerhouse surfer. I like his surfing a lot, and the Red Bull has done this 21-day series, and they were profiling him leading up to this event, and seems like a great kid, great athlete, really competitive. He's off of Volcom. He's been a Volcom team rider since he was a kid. And I guess Sonny Garcia posted an Instagram talking about, like, oh, Zeke's off Volcom, Hawaiian surfers don't get enough support from the corporations, and then deleted the Instagram later. I guess the Instagram only existed for a few hours, and then he deleted it. The rumor was that Zeke opted out of renewing his contract. Like, Volcom was willing to support him, and for some reason, Zeke backed out. So, curious about that situation.
Looking for a bigger deal, maybe.
I guess.
Yeah.
But
it's funny, you know, like, I always ask you, you know, how many pairs of shorts is Zeke Lau going to sell? You know,
right.
Like, there's only so many guys that are going to move product for these companies, you know?
Yeah.
And I think you're in an uphill battle if you're a Hawaiian, because the Hawaiian image is sort of one of thuggery, I don't know if that's correct or not. I don't know if maybe that's too much of my opinion, but I mean, when I think of a Hawaiian surfer, I think, uh-oh, I better put my head down and walk away, you know? Like,
interesting.
And I'm not saying Zeke's that way at all. I'm just saying that my, if I was a marketing guy and I'm like, should we throw dollars at this guy? You know, I want somebody that's going to sell product, not going to scare people.
Sure.
You know, and again, I'm not saying Zeke scares people. I'm saying that the idea of Hawaiians in general is kind of like a little spooky. Yeah. From a marketing standpoint. That's Do you feel that way? Or maybe I'm throwing too much of my own trip into this.
I mean, those assessments that you just made are fairly accurate, except those aren't in... Volcom wouldn't be afraid of that.
No, I mean, agree. Volcom's no, I don't mean Volcom. I mean it just Volcom's in general.
On board with Hawaii.
I just mean in general. Like if this was...
In general, yes.
Acme Surf Company, of and course. I was looking for somebody to drive my product, I'd look to somebody more vanilla like Brett Simpson than I would somebody that could be considered... you know, like whatever.
Dangerous element.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Volcom's the antithesis of the Acme Surf Company. You know, they're fully comfortable getting behind Kyborg.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
So you posted something on Facebook, Fergal Smith, the Irish surfer. He's got a web series called Growing. You and I have never talked about it on the show, but I've actually put it on my notes probably 5 times and we just never got around to it because I've been watching it on and off. I think he has 20 episodes or so out. I don't watch every single one of them, but I've definitely checked in with them occasionally. Have you been watching that series?
I just did that. I watched that one bit I posted and it was really cool, you know? And
yeah. He's this surfer in Ireland who just kind of self-publishes this YouTube series. They get insane waves in Ireland, like slabby, massive, as scary as anything we've seen coming out of Australia or elsewhere. Yeah, frigid. And then he lives this real...
Bohemian kind of like farmer,
but it's
tilling
not,
the land.
It's not bohemian in the like hipster sense of Orange County where you have everything at your disposal and you push it aside
it's
to live.
It's just the way he lives. It's just the way you live in Ireland.
That's the way it is there. You have to farm to get your food.
Like potato milk.
Knit your own clothes.
Yeah.
Van life is a way of life because it's necessity, you know?
Yeah.
So it's rad to see. He's a homegrown dude, but seems amazing. And I admire their surfing and how hard they have to work for it and how good they are.
Yeah.
It's like I have all this stuff at my disposal and I'm not as good of a surfer.
I think it's a young man's game over there to surf in those elements with that kind of power and those, you know, I think you don't see too many older surfers in Ireland.
Well, that reminds me of Gary Linden this past week.
I have him on my notes.
Yeah. I mean, Gary Linden, 65 years old. I had him on the show a while back. We talked about big wave surfing and all that. The dude's 65 years old, paddled in at Piahi, got his first wave ever at Piahi. What do you have on it?
Basically the same thing, you know, that here's our, the vice president of the Big Wave World Tour or whatever his title is.
Founder of it.
And he has now surfed every wave that is on the tour, which I think is really cool. And I think that was one of his, you know, sort of desires, you know, was to be able to say, yeah, you know, I've surfed all of these waves. I can speak with some authority about them because I've actually ridden them.
Right.
And
pioneered some of them.
He was out there, right? And he didn't have a board.
Right.
And Ben Wilkinson, one of these big Australian big wave surfer guys, said, hey, Gary, you can ride my board, man. Let's go do this. And Gary sat and watched it for a little bit. And the opportunity came again when Ben goes, come on, let's go now or never. You know, like, and so Gary goes, you know what? I'm going to do this. And he took Ben's board and
shaped and, by?
I don't know.
Roger Hines.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, because I saw that board at Roger's factory a while ago. And I remembered it based on the paint job. And actually, Ben came out. Roger Hines did like this opening party at his shop and Ben Wilkinson came out to pick up that board and take it back to Hawaii because there was a big swell on the way. So I remember seeing Ben pick up that board. This was like a month ago. And when I saw that image of Gary, I was like, dude, Gary shapes his own boards and he makes incredible big wave boards. But that looks like Roger Hines' surfboard. What the heck is going on? So then I read the article and sent the photo to Roger. You know, I'm like, dude, Roger, Gary's riding your board. But Gary is probably 5'7" and weighs 160 pounds. Ben Wilkinson is 230 and is 6'4", you know? So the board was built for Big Ben. And and definitely has more foam than Gary needs, but still kind of an interesting detail, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I put a little Instagram on it about, you know, we got a 42-year-old Kelly Slater getting a 10 at Pipe today. Last week, 65-year-old Gary Linden paddling into a wave of Piahi. It's very inspiring for those of us that are getting older.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, really amazing stuff.
What else do I have? I had another page, but I lost it.
Well, let me then bring you up to speed on a couple of things. I feel a need to touch base on the Ricardo Dos Santos update, which we opened last show with. And I think everybody's seen the news that Ricardo Dos Santos was shot and killed. Some more details have come out about that that are worth discussing. Mauro da Silva, which is Ricardo's uncle, he told The Guardian that the exact situation that happened, we were unsure last time whether or not it took place on the beach and he was confronting the people who were doing drugs, or it was at his house when they were doing construction, and that seems to be true. Ricardo's uncle said that Ricardo approached the car and asked the occupants to move. The suspect said, "We're the ones who are in charge here." Ricardo's reportedly replied that, "Hey, this is my hometown and I've never seen you guys here." And Ricardo walked away back into his house. That's when the man opened fire and actually shot Ricardo in the back.
Oh, man.
So that's the true story as told by Ricardo's uncle. And the coroner's report substantiates that telling, which is that Ricardo took two shots in the back.
Wow.
From this drugged up military officer who is in custody and is going to get prosecuted and all that. But I, like I said, I think it's worth noting to point out Ricardo got shot in the back.
Yeah.
So wow.
That's makes it even worse.
Total bummer. Do you see Tyler Wright?
Yeah. That was gnarly, man.
So this week's update in people getting smashed on rocks news, there's actually two updates I have for you.
Okay.
Did you see Mark Matthews?
I heard about it. I don't know if I saw it, but...
Tell me about Tyler Wright.
Well, Tyler Wright was in an event in Cronulla, right?
Yep.
And the tide was high, and there's this little sort of like a concrete walking structure where it might even be like a pool, like a seawater ocean pool.
Yeah.
And the surf was up, the tide was up, and so the waves were breaking into it, and she rode up onto it, right? And she tried to retrieve her board, her leash was wrapped around one of the, you know, fence lines that kind of holds people back. Basically, her board got entangled in this piece of concrete and fencing as a wave smashed over her and just slammed her to the concrete, you know, in a violent manner. And
she
manned up.
Yeah.
I mean, it was pretty gnarly. Like,
she got to her feet on the concrete ledge where the high tide's breaking up against it, but her board was in the actual pool itself. And the leash was tethered, had her tethered to it still. So it's like she tries to get her board as a wave's coming to then get onto her board and jump onto the oncoming wave, but isn't able to retrieve her board in time. So like half-heartedly flails into the oncoming wave.
And it slams her.
Smashes her up against the concrete wall again.
Oh, man.
It's gnarly.
It could have been really bad. It could have been broken ribs, that whole thing.
Oh, yeah. It was gnarly.
She kind of got away with it.
Mark Matthews was trying to escape at Hours. He was exiting his surf session, like climbing up onto the rocks, and another wave kind of breaks. He's on his feet on the rocks, and if it were an ankle-high wave that washed up, he'd be fine. But it's like a chest-high wave that comes powering through and just cheese grades him across, like across 20 yards of rock. It's gnarly. And then eventually, like, kind of gets to his feet and stammers up the rocks. And he's like, you could see him checking his hands. I'm sure he got graded, you know? It's pretty gnarly. But two videos in 1 week of people getting smashed on rocks makes for a good week.
There's a lot of good video out there floating around. There's my must-see moment is this guy, Russell Burke, Australian, South Australian guy. There's a Vimeo that's floating around out there. It's titled Ghost.
Yep.
Russell Burke.
Yep.
And it's just got him at various spots, all ledgy, all gnarly. He's 16 years old.
He's super charging. Yeah, that's the thing, he's
16. And one of the ways is Hours, right that he's surfing.
Yeah, it is.
And it's pretty neat. I mean, if you want to get fired up, this kid charges. You know, there's every little surf community has got that 16-year-old where you're like, God, that guy's a madman, you know? They seem to come every couple of years where I live. There's a couple of just hellmen.
Yeah, but to me,
I see the 16-year-old Ripper all the time doing air reverses. I never see the 16-year-old Charger
kid. Oh, yeah, I see those guys.
That's fewer and far between, you know? Yeah. Like, we had Jay Moriarty at Mavericks. That Tahitian kid, Manoa Drolet's younger brother, Mahiti or whatever his name is.
Yeah, where I live, there's a couple little slabs, so there's guys that are sort of Chargers.
Yeah.
Guys like Brian Conley, when he lived where I lived. Brian was one of those guys. Andrew LaGreco was one of those guys. I don't know if you know Andrew LaGreco. Daryl Goodrum. There's guys, and then there's underground guys like Ryan Birch's buddy, Eric. He really charges hard. I guess what I'm saying is, in my little zone, there are these guys where you're always like, God, that guy's 13. Look at that kid. Right. You know, he's a madman.
Well, talking about Birch, that's an opportunity to kind of showcase where we're at Surfing Heritage and Culture Center recording today's episode. Shout out to them. They're doing an event this weekend.
Yeah, Saturday is the opening.
Are you going to come?
I am.
I'm going to come too.
Yeah,
I want to come
Saturday
record.
Night. With who?
I want to come record the thing just to have people talk. I was going to talk to Paul Straub about it.
But, yeah.
So what is it exactly? I know they're having Carl Ekstrom, Donnie Brink, Ryan Birch, and Tom Morey.
Yes.
Discussing.
It's basically a look outside the box, outside the lines is what I think it's called, the exhibition. And it's just a look at different board design, not your run-of-the-mill contemporary stuff, just like outside the lines. You know, a lot of asymmetricals. Of course, Tom Morey is a guy who's always had unique perspective on surfboard design. And Brian Birch, too, and Donald Brink, is a good friend of mine and yours, and a guy who makes some really cool boards. So it's just kind of going to be a fun look at boards that, you know, are left of center in relation to, you know, what you'd see at a surf shop.
Is it like a Q&A, and who's conducting the cues?
You know, I don't know that part. I know we'll probably get a better understanding when we leave this recording here and go out there and visit it, because they're probably setting up for it now. We'll be able to get a little behind the scenes look at it. But I imagine it's just a bunch of boards with some foam core storyboard stuff that kind of explains each board and each guy and what they're all about. And I'm sure there will be a Q&A that evening, the opening night, Saturday night.
So for listeners, that is Saturday.
It's February 7th.
February 7th.
From 6 to 9.
Is it open to the public?
I think it is, yeah.
Is there a charge?
There is a charge, unless you're a Shack member. For Shack members, it's free, but I think it's, you know, 10 or 15 bucks.
Cool.
Yeah.
Catered by Mahi Restaurant, I saw, which is Seal Beach Restaurant.
Oh, okay.
So food and drink and everything. Cool. So cool event. I'll be here. Scott will be here. So listeners should come on down
if you're
local.
Good. Yeah.
If you're not local, fly in for the event, you know?
It's going to be cool.
Got nothing better to do.
Yeah, I'm psyched on it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
I got something I want to discuss with you. I don't know if you've been following it or not, but it's so fascinating to me. Becoming Westerly Wendina. I mean,
hasn't she already become Westerly, or is she still becoming it?
This
is
a heady topic, man.
It's an old topic. I mean, I've discussed this at length before you were on the show. We used to talk about Westerly, but...
Well, the reason why it's relevant now is Jamie Brissick has a new book.
Right.
And Jamie Brissick, the book actually just got released in Australia this week, and
it's the story of Westerly?
It's Becoming Westerly is the title.
Yeah.
It'll be available in the United States on July 1st. Westerly, do you want to give... Let me give the background, basically. There's a innovative, drama-prone Australian surfer from Gold Coast, Queensland, kind of in the
60s. He won some national titles in the 70s, named Peter Drouin.
Yeah.
Invented the man-on-man format.
That's right.
Amazing surfer. He's the only surfer that we know, kind of professional surfer, to come out as transgendered. So that's now where our story picks up.
But he's not even transgendered. Isn't he becoming a woman? Like, isn't he now a full-fledged woman? Like, didn't he do the operations and everything? And
you're right. I don't know how we define transgendered.
Yeah, I don't either, but...
So,
anyway,
he identifies as transgendered.
You're right. Peter was extremely important to competitive surfing by sort of coming up with the man-on-man format. He was the guy. The reason we see man-on-man now is because of Peter Drouin. And I believe the first one was at Burley Heads at the Coca-Cola event at Burley Heads was the first. It was like the 77 or 78 Coke event. Man on man. And an interesting guy or woman at this point.
But his stuff prior to this transgendered thing is so interesting to me. Just him as a surfer.
Well, he was, into acting and stuff.
Right? He was a dramatic actor. He started all these businesses. I've known people like this in my life, where it's like they really have this engine and charisma that you love, and they'll get something perpetuated and going and then disappear from it without reason or without explanation. Maybe they burn a couple bridges along the way sometimes.
You know,
there might be an element.
Depressive.
There may be some elements of that in it. One thing that I loved about it, about his background, was he had long been retired from competitive surfing, but he called out Mark Richards in Mark Richards' prime, basically, in a man-on-man world masters super challenge is what he called it in 1984.
Yeah.
Just like he's retired and gone away and just calls out the top guy, like calling out John. It'd be like Sean Thompson calling out John Florence right now, like, hey, we're going to have a surf-off man-on-man world masters super challenge. And so they actually did this event, and he hyped it up and promoted, took ads out in the magazines, and basically said in one of the magazines, I'm going to kill or be killed in this event, with ketchup splattered across his body, you know? And
he had a flair for the dramatic.
In the event itself, Mark Richards was way ahead on points, so he was going to win. And in the final, Peter Drouin claimed that he got struck by lightning, came into the beach, called himself disqualified, and therefore we cannot declare a winner, and we're both going out of this equals.
All planned, I'm quite sure.
I love it. He called it a tie, declared it a tie.
The only surfer to ever tie Mark Richards.
And people are like, well, there was no lightning. He's like, oh, you didn't see it. I got struck. You know? So, I mean, such an interesting character, and I love that detail of the story.
Well, I'm going to read the book. I'm a big fan of Jamie Brissick's. And
totally. So Drouin began to think about changing sexual identity in 2003 after a burst eardrum caused by a wipeout at Burley Heads. He basically came to and just thought,
I'm different.
That's the day my life had changed. Peter had died, and this girl popped out. And Jamie Brissick did a Kickstarter for a documentary that he wants to make, which was fully funded. I think it was like a $50,000 target, and they made $60,000 or $80,000. So that is in production. But in the trailer for it, they're interviewing Westerly, and it's interesting to hear Westerly talk about Peter, referring to Peter as a separate person and saying, you know, Peter was such a lovely young boy, and he always struggled with this or that, but he was, it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, you know, I think what's fascinating here is this person just so incredibly intelligent, you know, like... is he crazy, or is he so intelligent that it's just like beyond?
Well, people...
Or is he crazy, just like out there lunatic?
They interview Rabbit Bartholomew and a lot of Nick Carroll, a lot of professional famous people that we know and whose personalities we know, and we respect their opinion. And some of those people even thought it was some sort of a hoax or even just an art project.
Yeah.
Like, Peter's so out there, and he's got a... like you said, flair for the dramatic. He's actually got professional acting credits.
Yeah.
That this could just be his greatest show yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And Jamie Brissick has spent 6 years developing this book and writing it.
I mean,
it.
You got to wonder, like, if this is something that you undertake, would you want it to be so publicized? Like, wouldn't you want your transformation to just be, like, really, it's a personal thing. It's a private thing. Like the fact that Peter's like, yeah, let's do a book, let's do a movie. Blah, blah, you know, it's almost like he's just reaching for more attention. Like, so is it an attention grab? Is it that sad that it's an attention grab? Or is this like legit? Or like I said, is he that intelligent or is she that intelligent that not only is she just following her heart and her gut and her internal motor on top of saying, hey, this needs to also be put out there and publicized for the benefit of more people like myself. Like, is there some humanitarian basis to this? Is there some, or is it just like this hideous ego thing?
That's an interesting point. And one thing that Jamie said was that actually Westerly doesn't identify with the transgendered community. Westerly is
a girl.
No, it's not. No, she doesn't even. It's nothing to do with the movement or to shine a light on transgendered persons.
It's all about shining light on him or her.
It's just, this is me.
Yeah, that's.
I'm an individual. This is the way my life is. It has. I can't speak for transgendered community.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it's framed by Jamie. You know, I hope.
Well, like I said, Jamie, because
he's pretty close to Peter or to Westerly, and I hope he's not too close to have like.
An objective.
The glasses taken off, you know, the rose-colored glasses.
All I know is he has done his research. He spent 6 years with Westerly.
Yeah, this story's been going for a long time.
Yeah. So. It's so fascinating to me. Like, all of it is fascinating, but to watch Westerly in the trailer for the documentary is a whole new level of interest. Seeing the way that Westerly communicates about Peter, and it's
I just hope it's not this... self-glorification
it thing. Doesn't seem
you know
to
what
be.
I mean, like, I don't want to get dragged into somebody waving the flag and saying, look at me, like,
dude. Westerly,
there's so much other interesting stuff in the world than that. I mean,
Westerly,
I might as well watch the Kardashians, you know, if you're just gonna wave.
Speaking of which,
what,
Bruce Jenner,
I know,
is now identifying as transgender and doing a documentary reality series about the process.
I just think, like, I'm not sure I want to waste my money on that.
No,
you know,
but
I'd rather go learn about World War II.
Oh, well, absolutely. That has a lot of interest to me as well. But what's interesting, or if Westerly was selling a line of bikinis as a part of this.
Well, he's selling something. See, it's not a commercial. Well, he's selling himself. That's what my point is. Like, he's selling, look at me. That's what he's selling, you know. Yeah. We think. And it could.
To me, it seems like Jamie pursued the story more than Westerly reaching out to Jamie asking to tell the story.
Well, I hope that's the case. But we know he's a clever guy. You know, who knows
totally. What
kind of web he's weaved.
They show in the trailer Westerly paddling out for a session. Like, walking down the beach in a one-piece bikini, and she even says to the camera, she's like,
I'm
going to go show you how I can surf as good as Peter used to. But they never show her catch a wave.
Oh, that's the hook. They're trying to hook us.
I wanted to see. I'm like, dude, this is going to be so weird if this girl stands up and rips the crap out of a wave in a one-piece.
I wonder if she's going to surf like a female.
It's all.
Is there such a thing?
It's super intriguing to me.
It is.
That was part of the Super Bowl thing. Like,
I know.
Throw like a girl sort of a thing. How do you feel about that?
Backlash. I kind of felt like that was, they were patronizing to the female gender. I thought it was kind of lame.
Yeah, I do too. I
know my wife thought it was lame too. She's like, this is lame.
Yeah. Yeah.
Throw like a girl. What the hell?
Right.
Just throw like a human.
Right. Exactly. Must-see moment for me. I know you already gave yours. Was one wave that took place at Pipeline in this past week, surfed by two people.
Oh, that is awesome. I know what you're going to say, and it's on my list too.
Mark Healy.
Yeah.
Shouts out to Michael Ho in advance. Mark Healy's sitting deeper, and he tells Michael Ho, he's like, dude, I got a GoPro in my hand. I want you to take off on a wave. If the right one comes, you take off in front of me. I'm going to get barreled behind you and shoot the thing on my GoPro. And they do it successfully. They both get proper barreled on the thing.
Awesome.
And they've got multiple angles of the wave, except Healy did not frame it properly while he was riding in the tube behind Michael. So unfortunately, the GoPro footage isn't that killer. He posted a frame grab of it on his Instagram. So we will, of course, regram that at Surf Splendor and at Boardroom Show. And it's a cool frame grab, you know, deep in the barrel at Pipe with Mike Ho getting getting shacked in front of you, which is pretty rad.
I've seen the video. You didn't see the video?
Yeah. The video I got, but the video's the beach angles. Right. You didn't see the GoPro angle, did you?
No.
No. Nobody. He hasn't posted it because Mark Healy said it's kind of out of frame. But that's my must-see moment, dude. It's a proper barrel for both guys.
Cool.
More proper for Mark, but still pretty rad for Michael. Do you have a Duke and Coop?
Well, my Duke is Gary Linden, and I think it's a co-Duke because I'm going to throw Michael Ho in there too because these old guys inspiring us.
Crap.
Is that your phone?
Dude, I just blew it. Sorry.
What'd you do?
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm getting a phone call from my wife in the middle of the show.
Oh, that's all right.
Sorry about that.
Damn you, woman. So that's my Duke, Gary Linden and Michael Ho for charging at a ripe age.
Yeah, for sure. How old is Michael Ho?
I want to say he's like 56. Something like that.
Yeah.
He might even be a little younger, but right around 56.
And Mason, by the way, I said placed second in the Vulcan Pipe Pro. Mason's ripping.
Yeah, that was fun.
Love it.
Yeah.
Riding giant long surfboards.
I don't have a kook.
Well, let me give you my Duke. My Duke is the Bure Beach Surf Club. Have you heard of the Bure Beach Surf Club?
No.
Well, they are my Duke of the Week.
All right.
They're located in Sierra Leone, which is shocking. Hundreds of people are infected each week in Sierra Leone from Ebola. Yeah. It's like one of the epicenters of Ebola. The death toll was at 3,000 at the time that this article was published. This article's in the New York Times, and it was sent to me by listener Brent Baker. He's like, dude, these guys are the perfect Dukes. Basically, this club was just getting going when Ebola hit, and the idea behind the club, founded in 2012, is run by poor fishermen, kind of like a cooperative, was just to enhance ecotourism, protect Sierra Leone's pristine coastline, and create some jobs. Bure Beach is the only surf club in the country, and about 30 or so surfers kind of eke out a living by renting out boards and cooking up beachside meals to the tourists that come visit. But there's no tourism anymore because of Ebola. So they're just kind of running this surf club, but it also, it's a therapy basically for poverty-stricken people, of course, but also for the Ebola patients who exercise helps with the disease, you know? Mm. So really interesting story on New York Times. I'll post a link to it on surfsplendorpodcast.com. That's my Duke. My kook is the Surfline Wave of the Winter program. I love the Wave of the Winter. I love seeing the winner. They make a cool video about it at the end of the year, but currently they have 138 entries into the thing. They need to freaking filter this. It's like they accept any wave submit. Anybody can submit a Wave of the Winter at Pipeline into this thing. And so there's tons of entries, and a lot of them are mediocre. A lot of them don't deserve to be Wave of the Winter entries. And a lot of the entries, there's multiple entries for the same wave, filmed from different angles. So it's like I'm watching entry number 65 and it's like, all right, there was a mediocre barrel by some no name at Pipe. Click on wave number 68, different angle of the same mediocre wave.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, this is wasting my time.
Right.
Surfline needs to put a filter on this thing. Give me the 10 best waves of the year. That's what I want to see.
All right. That's makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, good. I before we chime out, I'll say one thing. I watched a great documentary called Last Days in Vietnam, about basically the pullout from Saigon in 1975. Really great documentary. And then I'm reading a good book called The Guns of August, which is all the political drama leading up to 1914 and the start of World War I. So those are my two things.
You burned through a lot of books, dude.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah, and I guess until next time, you can contact David, hello at surfsplendorpodcast.com. And you can contact Scott at Surf Talk San Diego, surftalksandiego@gmail.com.
I love it. Sometimes I want to jump in and save you, but it's better just to let you try to figure out your own email address.
Let that brain go.
Well, you never email yourself. How do you know?
That's all right. Well, okay, until next time. Adios and aloha.
Right, you know the drill. Everything that we discussed in this episode is on surfsplendorpodcast.com. All the photos, video, on social media as well, at Surf Splendor. You can always follow us there. Also, make sure to rate and review the show in iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen. We've actually gotten some really nice, recent, well-written and thoughtful reviews, so I'm very grateful for those.
Please keep them coming. Of course, that helps the show grow, as I've said before. So, and always just share the show with friends. That's also important. Give them Chas Smith's episode, or maybe they want to know something about Firewire surfboards. Bang, here you go. We got more than you need to know about Firewire surfboards. Thanks, Mark Price, for coming on the show. Thank you, Scott Bass, for helping out and conducting that interview. Thank you, listener, for tuning in and sharing. Until next week, this is your host of Surf Splendor, David Scales, saying, shred on.